Thanks, Neil. Thanks for coming to listen to me. As Neil said, I'll be working jointly at IS and Princeton and Perimeter. So I'm going to talk about something that I've been doing in my PhD, and which part of that I'm going to continue for my postdoc at IS and also hopefully at Perimeter. I just wanted to say that this is something that I'm currently working on. So I don't have a lot of conclusive results to show, but I just wanted to show you how I'm doing, what I'm doing, and I have a few plots in the end. So part of this I already worked in my PhD, and part of it I'm currently working on. So I'm mostly going to focus on the stuff that I'm working on now. Then in the later part of my talk, I'm going to show you some of the results that I got in my PhD thesis. I'm doing basically kinetic theory of self-gravitating collisionless systems, which many of the things that we see in the universe fall in this category. We have galaxies and cold dark matter halos. So basically, I'm interested in these two things mostly. And what I study is how these collisionless systems evolve under their gravity, so under the mutual gravitational interactions between the constituents of the system, that is maybe different stars in a galaxy or the dark matter particles in a CDM halo. So the way I study that is by looking at these two equations. So firstly, we want to look at how the distribution function of the galaxy or this halo evolves as a function of time. So this f here is the distribution function. So that is basically how many particles you have in each phase space element. So in steady state, in equilibrium, when our system is not evolving over time, then we basically need that your f is independent of time. So your del f del t is zero. And that gives us, from this equation, which is the collisionless Boltzmann equation, that the Poisson bracket of the distribution function with the Hamiltonian is equal to zero. So this term here is a Poisson bracket, which is basically the flux of stars that are entering versus leaving a phase space element. And in steady state, we have this condition, which means that our f can be written as a function of the Hamiltonian and other kinds of quantities of the system, such as the action variables. So now most of the stuff that I'm going to show you is going to be done in the action angle space. And what I mean by action angle space is basically you can think of the actions as sort of proxies for the sizes of the orbits that the stars are traveling in. And so you basically have the guiding radius of the star moving, which is basically given by the action L, or the angular momentum. There is action in the phi direction. And the star can also undergo epicyclic oscillations when you're in the co-rotating frame, and the amplitude of these oscillations is given by the R, the radial action. And if your galaxy is not spherically symmetric, then apart from these two action variables, there is another action, which is basically the action corresponding to the vertical oscillation of the stars above the midplane of the disk, if your galaxy has a disk or it's an axisymmetric system. But in general, in 3D, we have three action variables. And so these are the three sizes in three different directions, you can say. And the phases along these orbits are given by the angle variables.
But it's not an integrable potential.
Yes, then you don't have this. So you need Hamiltonian to be integrable. Yeah. This is only valid for strictly for when you have an integrable system, so that your Hamilton-Jacobi equation is separable, and blah blah blah. So yeah. So basically, you need to have symmetries in your system, a spherically symmetric system. For example, your angular momentum is conserved, and so is your radial action, and your motion is basically going to happen in an orbital plane, which is defined by the angular momentum vector, and this inclination is going to be conserved, and this plane is going to be fixed basically. So your longitude of the ascending node that is going to be fixed. Let me call that W or something, and this inclination is also going to be fixed. So there are going to be four conserved quantities for a spherically symmetric system in general. And on top of that, if you have an Keplerian potential or a spherical harmonic, the harmonic potential, then in those cases there is another conserved quantity, which gives you a total of five conserved quantities. So I am looking into looking at systems where the unperturbed system has sufficient symmetry such that your dynamics is governed by the actionable, can be described by the actionable variables. Right. So as I was saying, in equilibrium, that is in absence of any perturbation, I can write down my Hamiltonian as a function of the actions through the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. And so your F can also be written as a function of the Hamiltonian and the actions. And this is basically the statement of the strong genes theorem. Now this is in the unperturbed state. So when there are no perturbations. But what I am interested in is what happens away from equilibrium. If you perturb the system somehow, let's say there's another galaxy which is coming by having a gravitational interaction with this galaxy or something like that, then what happens to that galaxy, how it evolves over time, how it responds to the perturbation, and how that responds, basically what happens to that response in the long run. So when we have that, sorry, this is H naught. So the H naught is the unperturbed galaxy potential, galaxy Hamiltonian. And now in presence of perturbation, we can have two terms in the here in the Hamiltonian. The first of that is the external perturbable potential. Yes.
So how does your sort of vanilla thermal distribution function fit into this? I mean, they sometimes people take F zero to be like a Boltzmann distribution of thing because.
Right.
I mean, by definition, a thermal distribution would be time independent. But you're telling me I could be considering also other F zeros that are time independent but are not thermal.
Yes.
Okay.
So it is. So a thermal distribution is actually not very obvious in a gravitating system with governed by long range interactions.
Right.
So even if your distribution can look locally Maxwellian, globally it can behave very differently. So. So you can basically work out what your distribution function looks like if you have a spherically isotropic system and if you're given with a density and potential pair.
Sorry, does this H0 include some gravity?
Yes, so it includes the self-gravity of the system, the unperturbed galaxy.
Okay.
So yeah, so this H0 is basically your kinetic energy plus the potential of the galaxy. Now, depending on what this is, you can have different F naught, and that can be substantially different from Maxwellian in gravitating systems. You can have a power law distribution as well in some cases, but it really depends on what potential you have. Right. So, and we do not really expect to have the thermal distribution per se in gravitating systems because there are no collisions in the system, and it is, I think it's mostly the collisions which can drive a system towards Maxwellian distribution. So that's why we can deviate from Maxwellian. So I'm not assuming a thermal distribution as an unperturbed state. I'm going to assume anything which we can obtain from the galaxy potential. Right.
I think maybe it's a little bit misleading because you, I mean, the galaxy potentials tells us what the action variables are.
Yes.
So you could have any function of them. So that's an independent choice.
Yes. So you need to, you need the Poisson equation as well to specify what that exact function is. So if you have this thing, and your F naught, right. So then, so basically what you have is, let's say you're, so you need to assume symmetries. Let's say you're working in a spherical symmetric system. In that case, you can basically something like square root of 2 minus phi naught f naught dE. So if you specify the potential, and then I think you can, so you definitely can specify the distribution function.
F0 is just a function of energy, but for example, if it's a function of energy and angular momentum.
Yes, then you cannot.
Then you cannot.
No, so yes. So you need two things. One is spherical symmetry, and the other is isotropy. So which means ergodic distribution, or F is just a function of energy. If that's the case, then there is a unique mapping between the F and the phi. Otherwise not. Yes. And I am going to assume spherical symmetric and isotropic systems for the time being. But this analysis that I'm going to show you does not depend on that. You can have any F naught as a function of E, L, and et cetera. But in that case, there won't be a one-to-one mapping between F naught and phi naught. Right. OK. Yeah. All right, so the way to do this would be to solve these two equations self-consistently. So the F here, the evolution of the F depends on the Hamiltonian, which includes the potential, not only due to the external perturber, but due to the response of the galaxy itself to the perturbation. And this potential, in turn, is given by the Poisson equation. This potential depends on the density, basically, which is an integral of the velocity space of the distribution function. Now, solving these two equations self-consistently, generally for any perturbation, is very hard. It is a system of coupled partial differential equations, not only differential, but also integral. So integral differential equations. So we need to make some assumptions. And the first assumption is that your perturbation is weak. So your phi p, strength of the phi p, is smaller than the unperturbed galaxy potential, galaxy Hamiltonian, which tells you that the potential due to the response as well is going to be small. Only in the cases when the system is stable to the perturbation. If the system is linearly unstable, as I'm going to show you, that can happen sometimes. For example, Jeans instability is one such instability. In that case, this is not going to be valid. It's going to break very soon. You're in the nonlinear regime pretty soon. So I'm going to stick to stable systems, systems which are stable to the perturbation. So that's when you can use perturbation theory and the philosophy of that is that since you have small perturbations, then you can expand your F as a perturbation series or power series in some perturbation parameter. And that perturbation parameter in this case is basically something like the mass of the perturber by the mass of the galaxy. And in that case, you can expand your F as a perturbation series and your potential due to the response due to the F as also a perturbation series. In this case, I am assuming that your phi p, the external perturbation, is of order one. Because the perturbation parameter depends on the external perturber potential. Right, so once we assume that our f and phi can be written as a perturbation series, then we can substitute that in these equations and get equations for the perturbations.
Are you going to enforce positive definiteness on f?
Yes, f is positive definite. So physical systems, you need f to be positive. And as I'm going to show you, there's a constraint on the gradient of f as well in order to have stable systems. So yeah, the foremost condition is f greater than zero. And that is constrained by the kind of potential that you're allowed to have. So you're only going to look at potentials for which f is greater than zero throughout the space. And there is another constraint on the derivatives, which I'm going to come back to.
I don't understand that phi p of order one. I thought you had the big perturbation.
Not order one, I should say. Is the first.
Or the epsilon or something.
Yeah. Yeah, it's basically epsilon times. Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
First order perturbation.
Yeah, first order perturbation. Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry for the confusion. Yeah. Yes. So this is of order epsilon. This is epsilon squared and so on. Yeah. So then.
What do you want, right?
Yeah. I think I'll do that.
You have six.
Not very used to this. There's another one.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to use this for a little bit more.
Actually, there's more.
So basically, if you now write down your evolution equations for the perturbations, then that looks like this. Not phi p. Actually, this is of order one. This is I minus one plus sum over j f I minus j phi j. So that will be your governing equation for the ith order perturbation. That's the collisionless Boltzmann part. And the Poisson equation would be, since that is linear, basically it just depends on Fi. So these are the two equations that I'm going to solve. So here phi p is given, h naught is given, and f naught is also known. So given f naught, you can get f1. And since this is a recursion relation, given f1, you can get f2, and so on. So that's basically how the philosophy of this thing.
So
phi
p you are imagining is some gravitational perturbation, or?
Yeah.
Okay.
In this case, it's just gravitational perturbation. But this can be applied, none of this is only for gravity. Like whenever you have the Poisson equation, like in plasma, you can do this thing in plasma as well.
So yeah, so the second question is does phi p itself have perturbations?
Like phi p is itself the perturbation to the system.
It's prescribed, I guess, is the question, as opposed to being a dynamically evolving quantity.
Oh, phi p is a dynamically evolving quantity.
But it's prescribed.
Right? It is prescribed, yes. So it's externally imposed. You're saying that there's maybe another galaxy or a black hole passing by the galaxy or something, which you already know that the time behavior, you know, you have to know the time behavior of that perturbation.
I see. Let's say like an LMC is perturbing us, like we are now counting our perturbation to the LMC and how that affects that.
So that can also be taken into account in principle. You could get that phi p to be time evolving, and the time evolution of that phi p can depend on this galaxy or that galaxy or something else. So all of this can be done self-consistently. It just becomes intractable after some time. So, but it is possible to model two galaxies merging, for example. In that case, it's self-consistent. You have to solve the Plasov equation for this and this at the same time, as well as the Poisson equation. And there will be coupling between the two. So yeah, in principle, that can be done. But in this case, I'm just looking at one galaxy and something else that is perturbing it. Right. So, okay. So then, so I'll be going term by term here. First, I'll be looking at the first order perturbation, which will depend on the unperturbed galaxy Hamiltonian, the unperturbed distribution function, and the perturber potential, and the potential due to the linear response itself. And that will be given by the Poisson equation. Okay, so that's the first order perturbation. Now, you can also write down the second order equation. It's a little more complicated. There'll be another term, H naught plus F1 phi P plus F1 phi 1 phi 2. And then your phi 2 depends on F2. So first I'm going to look at this. This is more simple. And this is interesting because the first order, the linear response is going to give rise to certain phenomena like phase mixing. It's basically, as the name suggests, it's a mixing of the phases, of the coherence in the phases. So if you initially have developed some coherence in the phases of the stars, so initially the galaxy is all phase mixed, but then you impose an external perturbation, let's say a galaxy which is passing by that's pulling all the stars. So it's basically introduce a phase coherence to the stars in the galaxy. And now how that coherence is going to be destroyed because of the oscillations of the stars at different frequencies. So that's something that you can get from the linear response theory. Then there is something, there is the gene's instability. That is, you have a very large scale perturbation, then if that perturbation length scale exceeds the gene scale of the system, then you basically, the perturbation grows with time, so that's gene's instability. And then there's Landau damping, which you can also get from the linear response. So these are the phenomena that I'm after. This is very well known in plasma physics, but in gravitational systems, it's actually more complex to work this out, both these things. This is relatively easy. These two are hard. And this is the easy thing I did in my PhD. And this is what I'm working on now.
For your faculty, then you'll be looking
Yeah, the next step would be second order, higher order, and non-perturbative approach, basically. Yeah, I don't know if that's possible to do yet, but Right. So let's look at the linear theory first. And so what do we have here? Okay. So I will go to the action angle space now. Because of two things, because my unperturbed Hamiltonian is a function of both position and momentum, but in the action angle space, it is just a function of the actions. Because of certain symmetries, so that your system has enough number of tons of quantities such that this can be true. And also the Jean's theorem tells us that the unperturbed distribution function is also a function of only the actions in equilibrium. Right. So these are the reasons why I go to the action angle space. That means that we have to write these equations in the action angle space. But as I'm going to show you, the Poisson equation is going to be very hard to deal with in the action angle space. So there's some tricks that you have to employ to handle that. But these two, so the Collisions-Boltzmann equation becomes easy to write in the action angle space. So the Poisson bracket can be written like this. This term becomes this. And the other term here, this is basically zero because this is thing is zero. Because the Hamiltonian is just a function of actions and not angles. So I'm going to ignore that. And then similarly, since your F0 is just a function of actions and not angles, so one term from this also survives, and that's this term. So it's the action derivative of the unperturbed distribution function and the angle derivative of the perturbed potential. And similarly, this also has just one term. So that's the first simplification. By going to the action angle space, you reduce the number of terms that you have to write. And now the angle variables are oscillatory, which means that we can do a Fourier transform of this in the angle space. So our response is basically going to be an oscillatory function of angles. And this means that F1, which is going to be a function of both I and W, can be written as a Fourier series in angles, the potential as well. Now, this simplifies this equation further. And because the angle derivatives basically become algebraic. And this thing is nothing but the oscillation frequencies of the stars. So I can write down my L mode response. So the response, linear response of the L mode. This is a sum of over many, many modes. And in linear theory, every mode evolves independently because there is no nonlinear term in angles. So write down something like this. L. So yeah, so you expand your external perturbed potential in a similar way. So this we have to solve for every action, every set of actions. This is our linear response equation. This is like a forced oscillator. Basically, this thing is going to be time dependent. So in absence of any perturbation, this is basically like the solution of this is a sinusoid in L dot omega t. So this from here, just this part, the left hand side, you would basically get this thing, which tells us that the L mode oscillates at the frequency L dot omega, which means that every action is going to have its own set of frequencies. So this a star with a single action is going to oscillate at one frequency. Another star with a different action is going to oscillate at a different frequency, which means that you will have phase mixing, that basically two different oscillators oscillating at different frequencies. If you get the sum of the responses of them, you will find that it dies away with time. So, but that's not the only thing that's here. We have a forcing term on the right-hand side. And this is basically going to modulate the oscillatory response of the system. And we can write down, so there is one complication still here, which is this term here, which depends itself on F1L through the Poisson equation. If this wasn't here, so let's say that I neglect the self-gravity of the response for the time being, then we just have this, and the time dependence of this is prescribed. So we can write down, in that case, so the t. I have to cover that up for the time being. But if there is no self-gravity, which means that phi 1L is much, much smaller than phi PL. That's sometimes true. In that case, I can write down this thing. Homogeneous term plus a particular solution, which will go as so that's the solution for the linear response of the system in presence of an external perturbable potential and no self-gravity of the response. Right.
Can you maybe switch board? Sorry, I'd like to stare at what's behind.
Yes.
Maybe switch board.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So this is obtained by basically saying that this term is zero. And I cannot cover that. Can I cover that?
I don't know. The camera, I can't see that one.
All right. Okay, so yes. So now, depending on this, how this behaves over time, we can have different phenomena. We can have resonances. For example, let's say that this is a sinusoid. It has its own frequency. Then this term basically in the long term will give a delta function in the frequencies. So let's say that this has omega p t. Then this will eventually give you in the long term, a term like this, which basically tells you that whenever you have a quantum number here. So whenever you have a resonance between the frequencies of the stars and the frequency of the perturbation, then that's the only, those are the only stars that are going to respond to the perturbation in the long run, after your transient oscillations have died out. And that is what you have in dynamical friction, for example. So dynamical friction is nothing but, so the back reaction of the response on the perturber. If there's a perturber that develops some response in the galaxy, and then this response exerts a torque on the perturber and generally tends to slow it down, And that, in general, involves an, so if this the perturbator is moving in a circular orbit, so that's a single frequency, then that would involve resonances of this type. And those resonance stars are going to, are the only ones that are going to respond in the long run. And that resonant response is going to drive the torque mainly. So that's how you get dynamical friction. Right, and but this is only true in the T tends to infinity limit. But the transients are also important if you want to look at what is happening to the galaxy, how this response is going to evolve over time. Then for finite time, you will basically, from this equation, you will find that your F1 is going to go as this. So in presence of an external perturbator, this response, that strength of the response is going to grow or decay, but overall there will be always an oscillation of this sort. And this means that if you look at the phase space, then if initially you have a coherent perturbation, let's say, then over time, this these stars are going to move in trajectories like these in the phase space. So this one has a smaller action, this one has a larger action, and the smaller action one is going to move faster, and the larger action one is going to move slower. So this basically gets sort of turned into a spiral pattern. So you will find something like this in the phase space. And this is known as a phase spiral. But this is a transient feature. This, now in infinite time, this becomes so tightly wrapped that you cannot really distinguish this feature in the phase space. And then the only response that you're left with are the resonances. But in finite time, for quite some time, so the phase variable will take quite some time to wrap. And in that time, you will find these patterns appearing in the phase space. And this is something that has been measured, that has been observed by the Gaia satellite in our own Milky Way galaxy. We have observed these phase spirals throughout the disk, especially in the solar neighborhood, but also elsewhere now.
Spectrum of frequencies that you can say, like what
sets
it or make a prediction?
Yes. So from the shape of the spiral, you can say some things. So there are two kinds of spirals. I'm going to, maybe this is a good time to show you the plots, but basically there are two dominant spirals. There is one which is a two-arm spiral and one that's a one-arm spiral. And whether it's the one-armed or the two-armed, that depends on the speed of the perturbation. If you have a slow perturbation, then it mainly creates the one-armed spiral. And if you have a fast one, like a perturbation that is happening faster than the intrinsic oscillation frequencies of the stars in the galaxy, then you have a two-armed phase spiral. So there are things that you can say just based on how tightly wrapped the spiral is, or and the number of wraps basically depends on how long ago the perturbation happened. So if it's very tightly wrapped, that means the perturbation that happened, it happened a long time ago. Did I answer your question?
Or? I'm trying to think about the math. What kind of boundary condition sets the frequency of the system? Is it the time lapse from, seems to be that?
Frequency of the oscillation.
The number of spirals.
Yeah.
It's mostly the time, but also the frequencies that the stars were anyway oscillating with certain frequencies before the perturbation happened. So it's those frequencies, but once the perturbation happens, it creates sort of a coherence in the response, and then that coherence disappears because of oscillations at different frequencies. and that's how you get the spiral. But
it's a gradient, I guess, of the
It's a gradient of the frequencies.
Yeah.
And that's set by the potential of the galaxy. Right.
But in general, I guess we would expect to see like a sum over many spirals, I guess, if there's lots of perturbers happening all the time.
Yeah, that's what you would expect. If there are many perturbations, but that's not what you see. You see one dominant mode, and that's the one-armed mode in the solar neighborhood, which tells us that something about it, that the probably the perturbations happened not at the same time, but they were sort of spread over time, so that one phase spiral appears, it wraps up, and then another phase spiral appears. And then, so the one that we are seeing happened corresponds to the most recent perturbation.
It's like wrapping up, turning into being just a smooth blob. You're saying happens like it happens faster than the spacing between the perturbers.
That's the understanding, that otherwise we would not be able to see this thing. No. If the perturbation is happening very fast before the phase spiral can wrap.
If like spiral arms or like the bar were the thing causing the perturbations, then I guess then we would expect to see multiple spirals because the spiral arms are just constantly coming and going.
So if it's due to the spiral arms, then it would actually not see the phase spiral at all, because in that case, all the stars are going to move at frequencies that correspond to the pattern speed of the spiral in the long run. So for some time, you will have this transient oscillation. You will see this spiral for some time, but this will disappear. And then you will have a term that basically goes as the pattern speed of the spiral itself, because that's like a forced oscillator. So you're forcing the system to move at the frequency of the spiral arm.
Sure, but there's like young stars and old stars.
Right.
Yeah, so I can imagine if I split on the age of stars and I would see like...
You would see different effects, right. So for stars that are very old, you will tend to see not much of a spiral, but for young stars, which have only survived for some time, I think you should be able to see spiral. They do see that the spiral, the nature of the spiral depends on the age. And younger stars, so what is actually seen is that the older stars seem to be more tightly wrapped because they have been there for a long enough time such that they actually saw the perturbation that time. And the younger stars are wrapping up for smaller. So, yeah. There's a difference between an impulsive perturbation, which happens very fast, just once, let's say a satellite galaxy that passes suddenly through the disk, and a bar or a spiral arm, which has been going on for quite some time. And the satellite galaxy creates a phase spiral, like a satellite which moves in a sufficiently eccentric orbit such that it's an impulsive perturbation. It creates a phase spiral. That I saw in my work. But a spiral arm or a bar, which is not growing or decaying over time, it's just a steady perturbation, then that in the long run, it just gives you a rotating pattern in the phase space, like something that is not wrapping like a spiral, but something that's going like that, because all the stars are moving in the same frequency. Yeah, yeah, there's lots of things there, but today I actually want to talk a little bit about what happens when you do not neglect the self-gravity of the response. And in that case, so we have this equation. And so now this can be, so once we have the self-gravity term, then this becomes a challenge to solve because you need to take into account the Poisson equation as well. And the simplest way to do that would be to go to a Fourier transform in time Or in this case, since it's an initial value problem, I'm going to do a Laplace transform. So I'm going to take Laplace transform on both sides, this equation. And also a Laplace transform of the other quantities. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, that makes no sense without the T. All right. So that gives you something like this. Right, so, and then you can write down the Laplace transform of the response as plus the source term, the initial response here. So this is the equation that I'm interested in. All these are functions of the gamma. Now, this we can, this we know because we know the time dependence of the perturbative potential, so we can compute the Laplace transform of that. But this is not known beforehand because it depends on the response itself. And so you have to use the Poisson equation to get that. But now the problem is that the action angle variables are not the sort of natural variables for the Poisson equation. The terms get all coupled up. So there's something that, just a second. Okay. Right. So in the using the Poisson equation, we can sort of solve this. All right. It works. Basically, phi 1 of x b Green's function 0 E3x prime, and this in three dimensions is basically our prime. Now, let me right, but what I need is phi 1 L, so the Fourier transform of this in with respect to angles, I need this in terms of the response itself. And I don't want to bore you with a lot of algebra, but I'm going to write down what I finally get. So that can be written as an integration of the sum over modes.
Sorry, what is that first thing you wrote there? Is that a Q? 2 pi?
Yeah, it's 4 pi. Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
2 pi cubed. Thanks.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's 2 pi cubed, yes. That's basically coming from the integration of the angles, which is 2 pi cubed in 3D. Psi L prime di prime psi L prime. So it's this function here, which is basically the Fourier transform of the Green's function. And that can be, yeah, that is basically, this thing is the, yeah, Fourier transform in the angles. So the response F1 gives rise to a potential through this action angle version of the Poisson equation, where we need to know this thing. That's the major challenge here. And then we need to integrate over the actions to get finally the potential. Yeah. Now, this is a major challenge. I'm going to show you how to simplify that further. But using this and this, we can now get an equation for phi 1L. So notice that phi 1L at action I depends on the phi 1L at all actions. It's integrated over the actions. So that's a problem there. How do we invert that? And there is. Long time to write this. Right, so this is ultimately what I'm interested in solving. Sort of looks like an eigenvalue equation, a matrix equation, somewhat that the response at 1i depends on all i prime, summed over all the modes. So we need to somehow simplify this thing here. And the way to do that would be to go to a basis, to expand that in what is known as a bi-orthogonal basis of density and potential. I need this board. All right, I'm going to finish this as soon as possible. So you need to expand the phi and f phi and the density as a sum of basis functions which follow this bi-orthogonality relation. And that we basically need because we want to sort of decouple this this I and I prime. And yeah, then there follows a lot of algebra, which I don't have time to show you. And but what do you ultimately get by, and yeah, so one other thing that you need is basically a psi LL prime simplifies in this basis, can be written as a sum over the basis pairs. Just a second. All right. Psi LP. Right. And the psi L, these are Fourier transforms of the psi P angles. Psi L is basically right.
Should I just like mentally think of like the spherical Bessel basis as one example?
Yes. So a spherical basis is one example of my orthogonal basis in this case. If you assume that the spherical basis is a basis for both potential and density, then
Yeah.
Then that forms a bi-orthogonal basis pair. But the usually the spherical basis is good, but it does not have the same sort of asymptotics as your unperturbed galaxy potential and density. So that means that you will need many, many of these bases to fit a potential and density. And each of these, evaluating each of the matrix elements, I'm going to write down the matrix, but each matrix element involves an intensive sort of integration. So for computation purposes, you would like to choose a basis cleverly such that you just get away with a few bases. And the way to do that is to sort of solve the Sturm-Liouville equation or the Poisson equation and with the boundary conditions the same as the galaxy that you have. And then get a basis pair and use that basis. In that, so I am working on that now, but in that case, you just need like a few, five or six elements to get to converge, to make the results converge. Otherwise, for spherical Bessel, you need like many, many. So that was a problem that I was referring to the other day. But yeah, so now what you essentially have is a matrix equation. A 1 minus A plus S. And I'm going to write down what these mean, of course. The M is what is known as, one minus M inverse is what is known as a dielectric basis. This is the same dielectric that enters in plasma physics. And that is, M is the, it's called the response matrix. MPQ is, that contains information about your distribution function. So L prime, it's an integration over the actions. So it contains the derivative of the distribution function, and this is actually super important. Purposes. So Q. And S depends on the on the distribution on the response at initial time. Right. So, I'm almost done. Just 2 more minutes, and Right. So, these are basically your coefficients of the response in these spaces. So what this equation means that given your initial response, how will your final response response behave? That depends on the gradient of the unperturbed distribution function, and also depends on the frequencies of the stars. So essentially, what you are left with is this matrix equation. You need to solve this, and so remember that this is in the Laplace space still. So this is, I have already done a Laplace transform. So these are the Laplace transforms of the responses. And to go to the real time, so I want to look at how the response behaves in time, then I need to take an inverse Laplace transform. And that basically amounts to looking at the poles of this matrix here, because there's an inverse here. So what I want is determinant of 1 minus m equal to 0, and m is a function of gamma. Those will give me the poles, the values of gamma, which means that my response is going to go as e to the gamma t, corresponding to those gamma. So the main thing is to evaluate for what values of gamma the determinant of this is equal to 0. And that is a complicated exercise here. Because so this is a self-gravitating system, so it is inhomogeneous. And that basically means that you have to do this in the Action-Angle space. But a similar thing you can also obtain in plasma physics, where you have a homogeneous plasma governed by a Maxwellian velocity distribution and so on. In that case, this simplifies a lot. And then by doing this exercise, so this you don't have, so this is not a determinant there, it's an exact algebraic equation. And you can it's much easier to find out the poles in that case. And those poles, those values of gamma, tell you the growth rate or the decay rate of the response. And if your gradient is, okay, there's some more here.
There's only two more settings on this screen.
Right. Erase all this. So the sine of gamma will tell you whether the response is growing or decaying. Now, gamma is in general complex, so there'll be a real part and an imaginary part. The real part, the sine of the real part, will tell you if it's growing or decaying. And if gamma R is positive, it's the response is going to grow, and it's unstable. And if it's negative, then stable. And this regime is basically, this behavior is known as Landau damping. And whether you have gamma R greater than 0 or less than 0, that depends on the distribution function, or rather on the gradient of the distribution function. For an isotropic system, spherically symmetric and isotropy in the velocity space, in that case, you can write down your F naught as a function of just the Hamiltonian, the energy. And then that gradient L dot del F naught del I, that becomes just omega del F naught del H naught. There's a sine of this, which tells you whether it's positive or negative. If this is negative, then find that gamma R is less than 0. So your system is always stable if your distribution function is throughout monotonically decreasing, like in Maxwellian. But you can come up with various systems in various self-gravitating systems where this is not necessarily true. You can have a system with a kink like this. So there can be parts of the phase space where your distribution function is going to increase as a function of energy. And whenever that happens, then you find that there is at least one unstable mode, which sort of tends to remove this kink. So after some time, this becomes a stable system. But the thing is, it takes quite a while for this instability to saturate and for this unstable system to become a stable system. Can be in the order of several giga years for some cases. So these systems, these unstable systems, can exist for quite some time. And one consequence of that instability is what is known as dynamical buoyancy, which is the opposite of dynamical friction. So whenever you have a stable system, then if you place a massive perturber in that system, that will tend to lose its energy and angular momentum and fall towards the center of the system under dynamical friction. But if you, because that's going to lose its energy and the system is going to gain energy and sort of puff up. But if there is an instability like this, then the stars can actually lose energy and give energy to the perturber, and it can actually move out. And that's why there's, if you have like a massive nuclear star cluster or a supermassive black hole in the center of, or very close to the center of a galaxy, which has such a distribution function, then it'll actually tend to move out rather than fall in. And these systems can, so now the F naught as a function of H naught depends on your rho or phi as a function of R. And if you have a chord system, there is a very sharp transition in the core, then you can you actually find that there can be kinks like this in the F naught H naught space. And in those systems, you can actually find perturbers moving out instead of falling in. So that's one consequence of these of this phenomenon. And another thing, another reason why I'm interested in this is to study the, in general, the stability of gravitating systems. And there's this very famous NFW profile for CDM halos, which sort of seems to show a universal behavior. It's fairly insensitive of initial conditions. So that got me thinking that maybe the NFW profile is an attractor, which means that it this analysis might show that the NFW profile is more stable than the other double power law profiles. Or even if that's not the case, this will be an interesting exercise to me. But that's one big question that I'm after. I'm sort of trying to look at the stability of different double power law profiles, which give rise to different distribution functions, and see which system is more stable. But that's more or less what I'm up to now.